Thanks, Chris. Thanks to the other organizers. Yeah, so I've been working on some issues with high topography and black holes for the past 6 months or so. So three papers that are out here with a colleague at UCLA, Michael Goodperl, postdoc Martin Hammond, and a graduate student Eric Perlmutter. Okay, well, the first talk in this workshop, Dan, so I apologize at the beginning of this talk that wasn't have so much EDS and more CNT. So I some sense of the reverse, the reverse problem. There's going to be a lot of EDS here. Not so much CNT. In fact, the things I've been working on the past couple of years is probably the least related to stuff in this workshop, but happens to be what I'm excited about right now, so it's always much more fun to talk about those sort of things. But I think there is, it's not completely divorced from the kind of things that we're thinking about here in this workshop. And the main connection is basically trying to understand holography better at a fundamental level to really understand the rules of holography. And well, this may, you know, not have immediate dividends, ADS, CNT, but I think eventually this will be important. And so let me try to motivate that a bit more. Okay, we all agree holographic duality is certainly a very powerful tool, but it's still pretty mysterious. So how do you start with some weakly coupled theory and crank up the coupling and an extra dimension emerges with, in some regime, local physics and sort of thing. It still seems every time you see it happens, it's still a minor miracle. So that's just not sort of an aesthetic drawback, but has real sort of practical considerations, because a typical kind of thing that occurs, typical ADS-CNT scenario that I think everybody here is probably familiar with, is you try to model some quasi-realistic system by a bulk description. You do some calculation in the bulk, and you get perhaps some sort of interesting novel behavior. And especially when this is some bottom-up construction, you stare at this and you say, is this, you know, do I have a bold new prediction here for some new behavior, or is this just some strong coupling artifact, which I don't know how to trust? And well, you know, if we don't understand holography as well as we'd like, it's hard to answer these sort of questions, and so you're always a bit unclear. So in situations like this, of course, it'd be extremely nice to have some fully worked out examples of holography. You just take everything apart, find the rules, and really convince yourselves how things are working. Of course, these will be slightly different than the systems we're perhaps interested in for real-world considerations, but, well, hopefully it's going to be a useful exercise nonetheless. Okay, so with that in mind, it's useful to go back and to sort of talk a bit about what systems in the past, to some degree, in holography, to understand how to go from weak to strong coupling and what are the shortcomings of those systems. So historically, probably the first example, perhaps, of holography is this famous relation between 2 plus 1 dimensional Chern-Simons theory and a boundary 1 plus 1 dimensional Wessonian Witten law. Going back to the work of Witten. And so I think this is going to be called legitimately holographic, but it's a bit too, I guess you could say, trivial for the purposes of understanding interesting real world systems, essentially because the left hand side is topological, and this duality, the way this duality works, is you can basically gauge away all the degrees of freedom except for the boundary, and then you get some explicit representation of those boundary degrees of freedoms in terms of the WTW model. So very explicit, but too simple. And
I might have complained about this table. That is essentially the content of the ball cage correspondence in the quantum Hall states. Mm-hmm. So there is actually a real world scenario for that. It's not what one is trying to explain here. And I agree with you that this is a place of matter.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's really a connection. The quantum Hall states are real. And you have a real physical system with a bulk and a boundary, and you have real physical degrees of freedom that are living at the boundary. In this case, it's supposed to be sort of mathematical equivalence between a bulk theory on the one hand and a boundary theory. It's not that I have both a bulk.
Yeah, but it shows that pretty much.
I understand. Right. Mathematically, of course, it makes some theories, absolutely. Okay. Now, part of my definition of what's going to be make the system rich enough to be interesting is say that it has black holes in it. So we have some systems, some boundary theory, like you'll heat that up, and we believe at high temperature is caused by a black hole. So I want a theory that has black holes in it. This purely topological theory is not going to have black holes, although some version of this will actually come back later in the talk. Okay, so then another example, early example of holography was the C equals 1 matrix model. This came about by thinking about string theory outside the critical dimension. And after a series of manipulations and so on, there was some explicit relation between some one plus one dimensional theory of gravity with some scalars and a very simple quantum mechanics theory, just quantum mechanics of fermions, non-relativistic fermions, and some inverted harmonic oscillator potential, some filled up Fermi C, and there's a beautiful relationship between ripples in the Fermi C and fluctuations of quanta on this side. And so this is a very nice example. And so for a while it seemed that, well, perhaps all the issues of black holes and information paradox and everything could be just solved explicitly in this model. But history didn't work out that way. And the reason basically there's some subtleties. These theories do have black holes, but unfortunately if you try to form those black holes, you don't have a black hole to begin with. You try to form it by collapsing matter. The matter always bounces out in some way and scatters out before it forms a black hole. And on the right-hand side, this is related between an important distinction between like the singlet sector of the theory and the non-singlet sector, and you can go between them, and it never quite worked out. So sort of no real conclusive results about, say black holes. So interesting example, but still not enough. Okay, so then there's been recent progress in thinking about inequality, going from weak to strong coupling, powerful methods based on integrability and localization techniques. And again, these are very powerful, but they certainly rely extremely heavily on supersymmetry, and it's far from clear how you apply these to non-supersymmetric physics, finite density, or thermal physics, and so on. Okay, so now trying to look where to go. Well, of course, a nice class of field theories, or sort of prototypes for soluble quantum field theories, are in 1 plus 1 dimensions, so 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theories. And particularly the Virasoro minimal models are hallmarks of interesting theories that can be solved exactly. So let's talk about these for a second, see how they then extend them. Okay, so these are the famous series of models with the central charge. And well, these are nice conformal field theories, but of course they have small central charge, namely C less than 1. That's basically part of their definition almost. And of course, in holography, the central charge and the bulk is basically the ratio of the ABS scale to the Planck scale. And so C less than 1, you're talking about a Planckian geometry. And so one could try to set up holographic duality for this, but it's going to be a highly Planckian regime. And one might like to have something that connects on to semi-classical physics. And so having a theory that connects on to semi-classical physics, we want something where we can take C to infinity. Perhaps then we take C to infinity, perhaps then take C smaller and understand how corporate quantum effects, but we'd like to be able to have C large. Okay, well, there's a way to generalize these models to achieve that. And I'm not going to get into the details of CFT side of things, so these are just sort of crude formulas for our purposes. We're not going to really need details here. But there's a famous construction of those minimal models in terms of cosets. This is the GKO construction, where you have some SU2 WTW models at various levels and gauge some diagonal subalgebra. And it's well known that this is another description of those sort of minimal models. Okay, so the minimal model is related to level K in this way. And well, once you put it in this form, there's a natural way to generalize these theories to crank up the central charge. Okay, so there's a number 2 there, and what happens if you replace 2 by n? So you consider this guy, this cosine model. Well, there's a formula for the central charge. Here's what the central charge works out to be, and now you can see here that if you were to scale n and p large together, this factor out here will survive. And so you look at large n, so you have some large central charge family of CFTs, which are still going to be exactly soluble just because of the coset construction.
So there is another scale, which is the string scale. This doesn't guarantee the radius is large in relation to AAF.
Exactly right. So here, right, it's going to guarantee me that the EDS rate is large compared to Planck scale, but no other guarantees. Okay, so these guys are called the WN minimal models.
Just the name of this one. Can you give us a little bit of turning the ones into K primes? I mean,
Oh, can you turn the, yeah, the ones and the K primes? Yeah, what happens if you do that? I'm not sure.
It seems like you might do a larger central chart.
Yeah, yeah. Better chance. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so these have some novel properties. So the stress tensor, these are conformal field theories, the stress tensor, and they generate in Virasoro algebra. But these guys also contain a tower of higher spin conserved currents. So these are some operators which are purely holomorphic, say, but they're going to be on the anti-holomorphic side as well. But they have some dimension, say, here, like 3 on one side, 0 on the other side. So that would be a spin 3 current, spin 4 current, and then, in fact, with that n there, you have spins, all currents of spin all the way up to n. So, you know, conserved currents, these generate some symmetry algebra, some chiral algebra. And so here's what you, this is just schematic, but for example, you take these spin 3 currents and you look at their OPEs, that's equivalent to looking at the symmetry algebra. Well, the stress tensor part just gives you the usual Virasoro algebra. W3s, well, you get some central term here, some stress tensor stuff, some higher currents, and then, what makes life difficult here is you get some non-linear terms. Okay, you get some terms that are non-linear in the stress tensor. And then you can go higher here, work on more of these guys. You find various non-linearities involving the lower dimensional currents. And the whole thing, it's complicated. The whole thing is a name. This is the WN algebra. These things are much less easy to work with than the usual Virasoro algebra, precisely because of this non-linearity. It really makes life hell in many respects. And so there's this question of what does W stand for? And so you might say W stands for who ordered that, because these algebras, they're very powerful, but they're difficult to deal with. Okay. But as you'll see here, they emerge very naturally in gravity, very naturally in ADS3. They're sitting there in a very natural way, and so in fact, the easiest way to think about these things is through this gravity effect. At this point, you'll notice one important fact, which will be relevant later. So we talk about terms like this. So here there are these quadratic terms, and so I have to say something, of course, about how I'm defining these operators, defining this composite operator. So this is sort of a normal ordering prescription, and there are various coefficients appearing here. So in fact, I'm going to be basically looking at these theories for large C. And so we can be a bit cavalier. So there's sort of a classic, there's basically a quantum version of these algebras and a classical version. In the classical version, you can be cavalier about the normal ordering prescription, and there's some terms in the denominator, which you just look at basically their large C limits. But if you wanted to define these theories at low C, you have to be much more, you have to be more careful, basically. Okay. So based on, so Gabardiel and Gopakumar last year had a nice proposal. So they propose a large N limit of these coset theories. Okay, so we take the two parameters N and K here, and they basically proposed a Tuft-like limit. We're going to take K and N to infinity and define the Tuft coupling lambda to be N divided by K plus N and keep that fixed as we take the limit. Okay, then if you plug into the previous central charge formula, you'll find this formula for the central charge, which looks a lot like what you get in a vector model here. So lambda is finite, whole central charge is scaling like n, not like n squared, like n usual gauge theories. Okay, so what we have here is some soluble CFT with some large central charge limit, and we can define a Tuft coupling. And going along with that, we have some, in the large n limit, some infinite number of conserved currents. So there's some infinite dimensional symmetry algebra underlying these theories. And at this point, basically, we're just going to give this thing a name and call this thing W infinity of lambda. In fact, the best way to define this thing will essentially be from the gravity side. But it's some infinite dimensional symmetry algebra, which depends on this parameter lambda. Different values of lambda, you really get an equivalent symmetry algebras. Okay, so now we want to talk about the ADS dual of these theories. Trying to find an ADS dual. Okay, so in general, in ADS CFT duality, anytime you have some, well, the simplest case is you have a conserved current in your boundary theory, then on the gravity side, there's some gauge field, spin one gauge field. the stress tensor, you have the graviton. And so more generally, if you have some spin J current in the boundary theory, that's going to be dual to some massless spin J field in the bulk. Okay. So this theory has to be dual to some bulk theory, some bulk interacting bulk theory of massless particles of spin 2, 3, 4, up to n, or perhaps up to infinity, n, or something. Okay, it's got to be interacting because there's certainly going to be non-trivial correlation functions. In the boundary theory, things are not going to be some two-point functions and have to be able to reproduce those. There's going to be some interacting theory. Okay, now such theories of interacting theories of massless particles of higher spin are famously impossible in Minkowski space. This is the Coleman-Nadula theorem, so you can't have any more conserved quantities than Poincaré and supersymmetry. And if we had these higher spin massless particles, they would carry conserved charges and violate that theorem. And well, the theorem is a theorem, and so you can't get around that. But over the past 25 years, Vasiliev has been working on these theories, higher spin massless particles in ADS. And these theories do seem to make sense and be perfectly healthy in center space. And the reason why you can't get to the Minkowski space limit is these theories are going to be non-local. You have some non-local interactions. And the scale of that non-locality is going to be the ADS scale. So there's no separation there. So there's no way you can talk about taking the ADS space large, keeping other things fixed, given the Minkowski space limit. It's intrinsically tied to ADS. And so what you sort of want to have in your mind, at least some sort of mental image, is that these theories are perhaps some sort of model of some portion of string theory, but at the string scale. So just like the string is extended, has a scale of order of the ADS radius, and giving rise to non-locality at that scale. That's what these theories are, in a sense, perhaps supposed to be modeling, although this statement is not really made precise. There's no derivation of these theories from string theory, but that's what we'd like to believe.
Is there a Hilbert spectrum?
No. So it's not, you don't get the full oscillator spectrum, so it's just, so morally speaking, it's supposed to be the leading Regi trajectory, effectively, of the string. So we're going to not have all the oscillator degrees of freedom. Not going to be there. But yeah, but these, also I'll say a bit more about these things later, well, much more later. But what's nice is these theories share a lot in common with the full string theory, but so they have infinite number of fields in general, there's some non-local dynamics, so things are highly fixed by symmetry, but they're much more tractable. You can actually write down the full set of equations to these theories, isn't it? Well, it depends on how you... Well, then you can write down the full set of equations in completely closed form. They're not child's play exactly, but they're definitely more tractable than, say, closed string field theory. Okay, so you can actually work with these things and do calculations in a well-defined way.
So, Per, if you say they're non-local on the scale, string fit scale, or the ADS scale, is there a sense in which these theories are causal?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So one of the things we're going to find here is that I can show you metrics later where I have a given causal structure, then I'm going to do some gauge transformation to change the causal structure. It's a very delicate question. And I think that's, well, in any non-local theory, it's really non-local in time. Causality must be a very difficult thing to address, so I think, I don't know.
The correlation functions on the boundary will obey normal axioms of the CFT?
On the boundary, we're certainly expecting these things are completely healthy. So causality edge line of the boundary should be fine.
So is it clear how that happens if the bulk is some non-local mess?
Well, it's somehow due to all the gauge symmetry. I mean, that's what somehow is happening. But yeah.
It's not due to the fact that the boundary metric is sort of infinitely big from the bulk point of view. I mean, if the bulk non-locality is really at a fixed proper distance scale, then the boundary would still be local.
Yeah, that's right. I think, yeah, that's, Yeah, we'll see some more, issues with localities. Okay, right, so now given one of these, suppose we have one of these dualities, what kind of questions would we like to ask? Well, given some quantum field theory, one basic question you could ask is, what is the high temperature thermodynamics? You can see how there are some high temperatures. What is the high temperature density states and the entropy, and so on? And for what was one-dimensional conformal field theories and their corresponding ADS3 duals, it's a beautiful story. So on the conformal field theory side, of course, we have the famous Cardy formula, which gives you the high temperature entropy density states, purely in terms of the central charge and the amount of left moving momentum and right moving momentum, thinking about putting this conformal field theory on a circle. Okay? And well, then on the book side, we know how to match this very well. This is basically the matching behind almost every successful black hole entropy microscopic comparison in string theory. So there's some three-dimensional BTZ black hole sitting there in ADS3. And if you apply the area law, Bekenstein-Hawking area law formula to the black hole, it takes precisely the form of Cardy's formula. And so the entropy between gravity and CFD will match as long as the central charges match. And basically, what we mostly do when we match black hole entropy to gravity, entropy from gravity and CFD is basically checking the central charges are the same. And general principles tell you that this black hole entropy will match. So that's a very nice story. Okay, now let's talk about this in the case of one of these higher spin theories. So in the higher spin theories, besides just the left and right moving momenta, additional conserved charges, and in general, an infinite number of conserved charges, if I look at these theories, an infinite number of currents. And so it will make sense now to ask, what is the entropy at high temperatures where I also fix all the values of these charges? Okay. So from that point of view, what I'm asking for here is some generalized version of the Cardy formula. Fixing the number of charges, what is the asymptotic density of states? And then on the bulk side, I like to ask the question, do corresponding black holes exist, i.e. black holes that carry these extra conserved charges? Can I work out their entropy and compare that with the CFD? Okay, so the answer to these questions will be yes, and that's what I want to show you. Okay, so now we get into the nuts and bolts of higher spin gravity. So yeah, this is as painless as I can make it. Believe me, yeah, I went through the pain, so you didn't have to. Everything I'm talking about is going to be the 2+1-dimensional higher spin theories. These are much easier to deal with. Basically, you can work sort of step by step from what you know and then understand these things. At the end of the day, a lot of the structure carries over to the higher dimensional case, but higher spin gravity is has a fearsome reputation, and I think it's...
Before you move on, let me... I still want to understand your basic setup a little bit. The Coase model still has an SUN times SUN global symmetry, right? Since you started with 4 SUN globals and gauge the diagonal sub...
No, there's not going to be any SUN. The full symmetry is going to be this. So an example would be, say, because it's more familiar, the minimal models, which are built as SU2, so zero four minimals have no global symmetry. They just have zero sort of symmetry. So I mean this is part of the Coase construction. But yeah, there's SUN is not going to play any role whatsoever in anything.
But don't I get this by gauging the
you can think about it as gauging, sorry.
But
then you have to talk about which currents and so forth survive. And yeah, there's no.
So there's no global symmetry left.
Well, I mean, the global symmetry is this WN algebra, but it's not related to SUN. Okay, yeah. So first, just a few slogans and so forth there. Right. So I already said this. So you can think. So I like to think of higher spin gravity is kind of living halfway between ordinary low energy gravity and string theory. So hopefully, you learned something useful, like on a halfway point. So again, there's some infinite number of tower of fields, like in string theory, some non-local interactions, like string theory. And all these non-local interactions are not just random, they're fixed, basically uniquely fixed by this huge symmetry algebra, and it's incredibly constrained. Even things like you can't just add in a scalar field with some arbitrary mass. The mass itself is fixed by the symmetry algebra, and its interactions are fixed.
Something about non-normalization when it comes to quantum corrections.
Yeah, good question, right? Since everything is so fixed by symmetry, you ask, are there any possible quantum corrections? Yeah, there's basically nothing known about that.
What softens the high energy behavior of the loops?
So there have been no calculations of loops at all in these theories. So it's It's, of course, an excellent question. You might ask me to throw away so much of the string theory he uses. To get, yeah, it's an excellent question. I think nothing.
Because your field theory is like finite answers.
Right, the field, yeah, exactly. So, but right, so we might have to revert to saying, oh, I'm going to define the theory by the boundary theory. Hopefully we can do more, but it's an open question.
But wait, does this mean that the loop correction has to break the symmetry? Because this equation is fully specified by the symmetry, right? So in principle, you don't have any freedom to add anything if you want to respect the symmetry. So does that mean that any loop corrections have to break the symmetry?
Yeah, so when I say fully fixed, so I should have qualified that. So things like the, we know that things are fully fixed. Okay, I should back off from that. So things like, say, the masses of fields you can add in, and certainly they're, the known way to write down these theories that there's basically a discrete set of choices. It wouldn't shock me if the answer is yes. And some of these theories will end up being dual to free theories on the boundary. And some free theories on the boundary should have some trivial 1/n expansion, which suggests there are no quantum corrections. So it's a live possibility.
There's not some sort of Bose-Fermi cancellation.
These are not going to be, no, these are not, there's not going to be any supersymmetry. Excellent question. I think at the quantum level, these both theories really, I mean, nothing has been studied as far as I'm aware.
In 75, you roughly have the degrees of freedom of one immediate trajectory. Does this account for all the operators in the dual field theory, or is this just some subset of the operators?
The fields to operators. Yeah, so there are going to be several sectors of these theories. So there'll be sort of your higher spin sector, which will map to basically the symmetry currents and so forth. So then there'll be matter multiplets we add in, and they should be dual to the other operators. And so the hope is you can map everything.
There would be an infinite number of matter fields to map to. Do you have things like trace?
Well, not necessarily a different number of matter fields. I mean, it could be, so we hope, for example, that you have multi-particle states. So you have a finite number of fields, but I can map an infinite number of states.
The basic fields in the total model are the group elements G, right? I'm living on the SUN. And do I get trace G, trace P squared, trace P cubed, rather these sort of operators?
Yeah, well, essentially that's right. But a lot of these things are going to be mapped to, analog of those things are going to be mapped to multi-particle states. So I don't have to introduce a new field.
So there's single trace operators in the language.
There's some language. I mean, this is all, these are words at this point, maybe, but some things have been checked, but.
The coded model is a gauge theory, basically, right? This was, I can think of this as being some, I haven't, or the n squared matter fields, which my group elements in division SUN.
Well, the simple charges that you have order n, so I'm not sure, if I want to think about it as, I personally will think about it as a gauge theory. I think of it much more as being like a vector model. I mean, just like an ON vector model. It's not like any other.
I have a question, perhaps this is relevant. There are these old papers that I'm sure you know well by Moore and Seibert, and they have a proposal to construct costed models using, essentially, to map them to some Chan Simons theories. So why aren't these Chan Simons theories?
Yes, yeah, so that's probably somehow playing some role. I mean, these are the bulk theories here are going to end up not being pure Chern-Simons theories. They're going to be Chern-Simons theories with additional multiplets included.
So these are necessary to make the costed?
Well, yeah, it would be, if you had the pure Chern-Simons theory, this would be topological, you know, would probably need degrees of freedom, and to the boundary, but there's undoubtedly some.
I mean, those were theories with finite C. Is it the large C unit that becomes instead of finite C are topological?
Yeah. Here, I mean, here these are. I mean, the Chern Simons here, the bulk here, are going to be based on non-compact groups and things like that. So there are different things going on, but. Yeah, and there's undoubtedly connections there.
So just to get you to repeat something you said a minute ago, you said these theories have no supersymmetry in them whatsoever?
Well, you can supersymmetrize them, but you don't have to. it's easy to supersymmetrize.
Which case, you just supersymmetrize the CFT dual as well in some sense.
Yeah, exactly.
But they're perfectly well defined if you're far from supersymmetry.
Yeah, they seem to be. Mm-hmm. At least classically, again, classically the bulk is what I mean.
Well, are these cases that Rajesh and Nakia studied and the well known, somewhat controlled CFT dual, those include things that have no supersymmetry?
Yes.
So it's more than just classical in the bulk.
Oh, you're talking in the boundary? I was like, yeah, classically and then in the bulk. But yeah.
There's evidence the theory really exists beyond that.
Yes, I mean, right, so. Sorry, bulk of the boundary. Yeah. So we don't understand very well. We don't. The bulk, we understand very little about the quantum. For example, how finite n comes in quantum effects, that is very unclear at this stage. So that's why I'm hesitant to say that I don't want anything really quantum mechanically in the bulk.
The boundary theory is a weakly coupled fixed point, so you can do that with everyone else.
Yeah, the boundary theory is undoubtable. I mean, these things we know, these things exist, they're healthy, that's that much we know for certain. But yeah. Okay, right, so let's go through how you define these things. So the historical starting point here for the higher spin theories was, so initially Franz Dahl formulated a free theory of massless symmetric tensor fields in ADS, and so these are symmetric tensors with some gauge invariance here. But that was just at the free level, everything makes sense at the free level. But it took a while to understand how to include interactions. And to include interactions, it's best to work in the gauge theory formulation of gravity. So again, I'm going to be focusing here on 2+1 dimensions. And so 2+1 dimensions, this means we talk about the Chern-Simons formulation of 2+1 gravity. So first, I'm just going to review the case of ordinary gravity. Just think ordinary gravity, Chern-Simons form. Once you have that, it's actually remarkably easier to make it into a higher spin theory. OK, so this goes back to Achuar, Townsend, and Witten. So we write down the Vilbain. And what's special to 2+1 dimensions is that the usual spin connection over here can be turned into an object with the same index structure as the Vilbain using the epsilon tensor, just again, very special to 2+1. And so now we can talk about taking linear combinations of these guys. So we take the sum and difference and associate these with generators JA, which are going to be SL2R generators. Okay, SL2R generators are bang some standard commutators like this, and this will be some tangent space Minkowski metric, basically. And so then we get SL2R times SL2R gauge fields. And the nice thing is that if you look at the Einstein equations with a negative cosmological constant and rewrite it in this language, it just becomes the statement that these two connections are flat. So you have two flat SL2R connections. That, at least at the classical level, modulus and fine points, is equivalent to the Einstein's equations with negative cosmological constant. Okay, and then of course, we want an action. We know how to get the instrument action. It's the Chern-Simons action. Okay. So another nice feature here. Oh, and then see that. Right. So then, so overall level K. The way you fix K is that you take this and rewrite it back in metric variables. You'll find this is the Einstein-Hilbert action up to some total derivative. And so matching the coefficients and the constant tells you the relation between K and G. And then the final thing here I wrote is probably illegible. K is C over 6. C is the Brown-Hanau simple charge. Okay, so a lot of what I can do here, actually, the whole theory basically splits up into this A part and this A bar part. And a lot of considerations, everything factorizes, which is a very nice feature. And so a lot of things, I'll do calculations here in terms of A, and then the same calculations will go through for A bar, which is the obvious substitutions I work on. Okay, so let's look at some simple solutions. So now I'm going to write these SL2R generators in a basis like this, which is familiar from conformal field theory type considerations. And so the simplest solution is just ADS3. So here are the connections. So rho is going to be the radial coordinate. Large rho is going to be the ADS boundary. Attach that to one generator. Stick in a e to the rho dx plus. Easily check this is a flat connection. Plunk through the dictionary. You get this metric. And so that's just ADS3 in Poincaré coordinates. The next simplest Well, the simple generalization of this is I have the same substance before, now I just added in this term. I added this term in with some coefficient curly L, some parallel structure down here. Again, easy to check, that's a flat connection. Work out the metric, what is that metric? That's the general rotating BTC black hole, okay, with L and L bar being basically left and right moving. So, in fact, if someone handed you this trend science formulation, you would just discover the BTC black hole automatically. It's just a very curly simple thing to write down.
But what goes wrong in a gauge theory language if you try to make something that violates externality bounds?
Externality, you mean if I try to make J larger than M? So then I get L negative, so I guess I'm going to get, oh, gauge theory, oh yeah, okay, so, right, so in gravity, I'm going to make it singularity, and the gauge theory language, yeah, actually it's...
Lots of simple gauge field configurations are bizarre pathological
matrix, right? Yeah, this will be an important point later. Many things look very natural in the gauge theory language. You say, it looks great, and you translate into a metric, and it's a disaster. This is persistent confusion. Yeah, so there's always a question about which do you trust and who do you trust? Do you trust the gauge theory? it's not clear, actually.
Eduardo can make the gauge theory in the lab, so.
Okay. All right, we trust Eduardo. Okay, one more thing we need here, one more standard result but in this language that before we go on, is the asymptotic symmetry algebra. That's okay, this famously is the Virasoro algebra, the asymptotic symmetry algebra ADS3. Let's just quickly see how it comes out of this formulation. Okay, so you replace L here by some arbitrary function of x plus. That's still a flat connection. You define such an A. That's the definition of what an asymptotically ADS3 metric is. So you ask, what is the general gauge transformation that preserves that structure? That's going to be asymptotic symmetry algebra. Look for some general gauge transformation that preserves that structure, but perhaps transforms L. A simple calculation, you find there's some free functions worth of gauge transformations that L transforms into that, and that's exactly the transformation law for a stress tensor in a CFT, and from that simple term you read off the eccentric charge versus the usual Brown and eccentric charge. Okay. So again, this is sort of the easiest, technically easiest way to derive the Virasoro algebra. It's extremely nice in this gauge-theory language. Okay, right, so now we want to generalize this thing. And remember before I generalized, I had 2 and I replaced 2 by n? Well, you play that same trick again here. So that gauge theory, that Chern-Simons formulation was based on SL2 times SL2R Chern-Simons theory. All I have to do is replace SL2 by some larger algebra that contains SL2. What I'll get then is I'll get some larger theory that reduces down to ordinary gravity when I restricted that sub-algebra. So it would be a theory of gravity coupled to some other stuff, but it'll include ordinary Einstein gravity as a like, consistent subsector of that. There's all the theory, all the solutions, ordinary gravity, at least solutions with new theory, but I'll get something bigger. Okay, so a very simple example of this is SL3. Okay, so write down SL3 Chern-Simons theory, and out of that you can defining some of the Gilbanes as I did before, then you can define a metric from this thing, and now you get a new object, a symmetric 3-index guy. This is the spin-3 field. And so this thing is going to be some diffeomorphism invariant theory of these guys interacting together. And indeed, this reduces down to that Fransdahl theory when you linearize around ADS, but is now some nonlinear extension of that. Okay. And so I don't know exactly who the first people were to write down this SL3 theory, but there's a paper from last year by Campolioni et al. Who's doing this in a nice way. I learned most of it. Okay, so now a conceptually interesting thing is this theory enlarges diffeomorphism invariance in a non-trivial way. So besides ordinary coordinate transformations, you have new exotic spin-3 gauge invariances, which act on the metric. Okay, everything's in SL3, everything's getting mixed up together. Okay. So a lot of what you normally think about as being invariant is no longer invariant. For example, you write down the Ricci scalar of this metric. That's diffeomorphism invariant, it's not invariant of the full gauge theory.
So are you saying that a solution of Einstein gravity is always a solution of this? In other words, there aren't any tadpoles for the SK5.
Exactly.
So that they might be pure gauge?
Exactly. That's right. So any solution of ordinary gravity is a solution of this theory. Yes.
There aren't any linear tadpoles in the 5.
Precisely. And it's just because you have an SL2R subalgebra, so you can take any solution, write in the gauge theory language in terms of the SL2R generators, you point that in. The fact that SL2R is a subalgebra maybe guarantees it's a solution. Okay, so now a lot of things go, the normal analysis is very similar to before. So we look at the asymptotic symmetry algebra. Okay, so now we have more generators, so we have these previous SL2R generators. SL3, say, has eight generators, so I have five more. And so one convenient way to arrange these things is to take these five to be like an irreducible representation under the joint action of these guys. Okay, so there's some new generators. And the analogous statement about what I meant before by an asymptotic ADS3 connection now generalizes to this guy, so I have this new term added on. And the reason you take this is you can always do a gauge transformation to put the connection into this form. So this is the natural form to write down. Okay, so you ask what's the general gauge transformation that preserves this structure? You now find two free functions. Okay, you look at the variations of L and W under those gauge transformations. Turn that into OPEs, transition algebra. What is that algebra? It's the W3 algebra that we talked about before, with L being the stress tensor, and this W is the spin 3 current. Okay. So this is what I meant by saying that in a fairly natural way, these W algebras come out of gravity, just out of simple science theory. This is sort of the simplest way to derive it. In fact, this procedure actually, I mean, has a, essentially the mathematical literature is known as the Drinfeld-Sokolov reduction, which is a way of getting from current algebras to the W algebras, but this is the physical version of that.
Can you make chiral theories by like varying the A and A bar over Andrians separately or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's purely, yeah, so you could, I mean, yeah, so I mean, K, the two K's here don't have to be equal. I could take one of these zero. Yeah, chiral theory. Yeah, okay, let's see. This is a slight aside here, but it's kind of interesting. These theories have multiple ADS vacua. So the ADS vacua are associated with some SL2R subalgebra, the full algebra. Now SL3 actually has two inequivalent SL2 subalgebras. So this theory actually has two distinct ADS3 vacua. Okay? And if you go to higher SLN, the statement generalizes to more and more vacua. Okay, and that new vacuum has its own asymptotic symmetry algebra, which I derived just by the same procedure I talked about before. And in fact, this thing's, well, so you get a different spectrum of currents. You actually now get, we have the spin 2, which is a stress tensor. You actually get two spin 3 halves, a spin 1, and this is actually something that was known back in the CFT literature. It's called W32. It's known as the Polyakov-Bershadsky algebra. But at least in the CFT literature, these things seem to be sort of disconnected CFTs, but actually now in this framework, you can easily connect them by some RG flow, because if you have two ADS solutions, you look for a solution that interpolates between them. It's actually extremely easy to find such a solution in this context, and here's the what turns out to be the metric, and there's some spin 3 field turned on, and so the two different powers of e to the rho correspond to the two different ADS3 solutions, and rho gets large or small, and so you interpolate between these two CFTs, which is actually an interesting prediction. I mean, it'd be interesting to actually verify this independently from CFT considerations, since there are two seemingly distinct CFTs. A weird feature about this, which I have to say, is that if you work out the central charges of these things, actually the IR central charge is actually four times the UV central charge. Opposite you don't expect, so first you have a little bit of panic there, but it's not clear physically what's going on, but it doesn't actually violate the C theorem. This is some like non-Lorentz invariant RG flow. And so the way the UV stress sensor and the IR stress sensor are actually don't flow into each other, everything gets mixed up with the other spins. But from that point of view, there's no contradiction, but physically, it's kind of think central charge should decrease. What is it about having there is unclear, but that's what you got. Okay, this is a bit of an aside. Okay, now back to the main topic.
Sorry, do you have some new quantum number, is analog of central charge in this generalized algebra? Say a new type of central charge?
Well, so every current has its own central term. But those aren't, they're not independent.
So there's only one?
There's only one independent one, and all the other central terms are related to the one, common one by the symmetry. In other words, from the OP, if you try to write down the OPs as an independent, you would find that you wouldn't have like an associative operator product expansion. They have to be related in precise ways.
Can you go back to the RG flow for one second? That form of the metric you wrote, that's not of a form that you can prove the sort of holographic C theorem for using the null energy condition? I mean, you just put one unknown function of rho in front of it.
Yeah, I mean, it violates these things. It violates, I mean, it would correspond to something that has you know, violates the null energy
condition. But I like the null energy condition.
You put it, yeah, I mean, you have to even talk about what you mean by energy here. These are, yeah, but morally that's what's happening, it looks like. Okay, so given one of these CFTs, so we expand, say, again, I'm restricting right now to the case SL3 or the W3 algebra. Once we understand this case, the generalization will be immediate, basically, so it's not focusing on this case. Okay, so we have the usual Virasoro zero mode, and now the zero mode of the spin 3 current commutes with the Virasoro guide. So we have these two commuting charges. And so it makes sense to look for black holes carrying independent values of these two charges. Okay. And from the boundary CFT point of view, well, I normally think about black holes as being essentially saddle point contributions to the partition function of the CFT. And so now I should be thinking of some generalized partition function where I don't just have temperature, basically, but I have some chemical potential for this extra spin 3 charge. So some spin 3 chemical potential, if I find a black hole, it'll be contributing to this partition function. Okay, and then if you said SL3, if you had SLN, then you have, you know, additional chemical potentials, and talk about black holes or partition functions with more and more parameters. Okay, so now we need to know, so we want to turn on this spin 3 chemical potential. How do we look for a black hole that would carry such a chemical potential? Well, I mean, go back to, say, Reisner-Nordström, EDS Reisner-Nordström black holes. We know the term of chemical potential. What you want to do is you want to fix the asymptotic value of the gauge field, E sub t, its asymptotic value of the chemical potential. Okay, so that carries over. So again, here, if you want to add a chemical potential, you're basically adding to the action some mu times the current. And then according to the ADS-CFT dictionary, mu is the source. So it corresponds to the boundary conditions for bulk fields. So I know how to fix the boundary conditions and correspondence with mu. And you can do some Ward identity analysis and ultimately find indeed this is the case. And so mu shows up as some particular term, some leading term in the asymptotics of the x minus component of the gauge field. Okay, so you have to fix that guy, that's fixing the chemical potential. And then it turns out to be quite easy to generate solutions that have that behavior. So you can start with, this was the form as I wrote down before, defining an asymptotically ADS3 metric. Now I got to add on some A minus with this asymptotic form. And I have to do so in such a way that I have a flat connection. And so in this form, to get a flat connection, you basically have to write down an A minus that commutes with A plus. So if I think about the generators here for SL3 as being 3x3 traceless matrices, there's an easy way to get a matrix which commutes with A plus. You just square it, take its traceless part, and then you can check that you expand it out in D of a term like this, and the coefficient is mu. Okay? So very easily generate a solution with the correct asymptotic boundary conditions. Okay, so now what do we have here? So we have, let's just count the free parameters. So the free parameters now are the two charges, the Virasoro charge and W. Everything I'm talking about is on, say, the left moving side, and the corresponding story on the right moving side, which just goes along. If I want to make this a finite temperature black hole, think about it as an Euclidean signature, then I only need to compactify one of the coordinates on a torus. So that's a modular parameter tau, so that's another parameter. And then I have the chemical potential, which I'm either referring to as mu up here or as alpha here, and they're related by a factor of tau. Let's not worry too much about that. Okay. So basically I have four parameters, two charges, two potentials. But now, of course, I know this is a thermodynamic object. I should be able to fix the charges in terms of potentials or vice versa. They shouldn't be independent objects. Okay. So in ordinary gravity, say you fix the mass in terms of the temperature by, say, looking at the Euclidean black hole metric and checking there's no conical singularity at the horizon. That fixes the relation between temperature and mass, and that's the relation. It turns out that none of that works easily here, basically because none of that kind of prescription is not actually gauging variance. So even the local geometry, say, around the horizon, or even the horizon itself, is not fully gauging variant. And so if you try to apply those sort of rules, you just get stuck. Similarly, even if we do that, how do we get the entropy of this black hole? So the usual things we have, the usual tools we have to get the entropy, like say taking the area law, that's not going to work because this is not an action of the standard Einstein-Hilbert form. But the Euclidean action basically also doesn't work, basically engaging variance issues, Wald formula, similar story. None of these things work. And so to get the entropy, you have to basically go back to first principles and say, what I want the entropy to do for me, I want it to basically appear correctly in some thermodynamical first law. I want to have that be the underlying principle. As long as you demand that that's what you really insist on, then you can make sense of this.
Sorry, your action would be gauging variant.
Well, the action is, I mean, the Chern-Simons action, so the gauging at the boundary term, and that boundary term, yeah, causes problems. Okay. So we're trying to compute this partition function. So here's the indirect way we have to proceed. So we don't know how to compute this thing directly. What we're looking for here is some rule that will tell us how to fix the values of the charges in terms of the tensions. That's the physical condition we want to have. If those charges are to come from some partition function, you'd get the charges by differentiating the partition function with the potentials. That's how you get L and W. If they're coming from a partition function, they should obey this integrability condition. So I want a rule for fixing L and W in terms of alpha and tau, but whatever that rule is, it better obey this condition, otherwise it can't possibly come from partition function, and that'll tell you that you won't have a consistent first law of thermodynamics. Okay. So again, in ordinary gravity, we fix this by saying that a smooth Euclidean horizon that smoothly closes off. Okay. I want to phrase that condition in some gauge invariant way. Okay. So Chern-Simons theory, which is a theory of flat connections, the only gauge invariant information are holonomies of the connection. So the only thing you can really do is you can compute holonomies of the Chern-Simons connection around this Euclidean time circle and say they should take some fixed values, and those fixed values should be the ones that define a smooth horizon in some sense. So how do you decide what the fixed values should be? Well, the only rule you could come up with is you take some known solution, like say the VTZ solution, which you know smooth according to your regular criteria, work out its holonomy, and you say, well, I just demand that any other solution had better have that same holonomy in order to define a smooth horizon. So that's the proposal, basically. Okay. So we propose this is this holonomy condition.
Sorry, VTZ is a two-parameter family of black holes that gives you a two-parameter family of allowed values? Or is that...
So let's just focus on one chiral sector. So the BTZ, of course, has, before you do anything, it's temperature and momentum. Then you have this condition which fixes a relation between them. And so after that, you have, after you fix that relation and you work out the holonomies, you find holonomies are just numbers, like pi, 2 pi. So no free parameters in the holonomy. So basically, it's actually the holonomy eigenvalues, you want to get precise. The holonomy eigenvalues are basically just things like 0 or 2 pi.
Is 2 pi the same as 0, or is it different from 0?
2 pi is different than 0. Yeah. Good at that. Yes, it is different than 0.
So, will that mean in the theory when you have NWN charges or whatever, you're going to get a very small family of black holes with many relations between the charges?
Exactly. The general case, we'll have an infinite number of charges, we'll have an infinite number of equations that relate to charges.
So you're not worried that you're missing other holonomies that are allowed but don't arise from BTZ?
There could be other solutions, yeah. I'm going to get solutions that smoothly connect onto BTZ as I turn off the charges. These are solutions I know. There could be other exotic things that are out there. Okay. Right, and so the minor miracle that happens is actually you put this holonomy condition in, it gives you relations for the charges in terms of potentials, and they obey this integrability condition. In a quite non-trivial way. So this rule is going to be consistent with the first law of thermodynamics. Okay, so you carry this out. So you fix those charges, their potentials. Then you can, once you have the charges, you can basically, well, the charges are the derivative of z with respect to the potential, so you get a differential equation for the partition function. You can integrate that, define all the thermodynamics, spare the details. But after all the dust settles, you get some explicit formula for the entropy of the black hole in terms of the Virasoro charge and in terms of the W3 charge. Okay, here it is in its full glory. Okay. So this is for this SL3 black hole, this is the answer. This is basically the Cardy formula for these W3 CFTs. So the claim is that any CFT with W3 symmetry and large central charge should have an asymptotic entropy which obeys this formula. And so you should be able to verify this independently from CFT. It hasn't been done yet, but this is, a prediction or something coming from the black hole side. Okay, so this is the SL3 case. Now we want to go on to the case that's more interesting, which is this case that connects onto these large n limits of these coset models. But as it turns out, everything I did here generalizes in a very easy way, and so I can skip all the details and just tell you the words essentially.
I can do this. One more question. And just from the CFT side, can you see that the allowed very, very massive states using CFT logic have relations between their WN charges, which would be consistent with your idea that the black holes come with this infinite set of relations between the charges?
Yeah, so later, there are engineering studies where we can get an explicit match between CFT and this theory, so we can verify all these relations. Why exactly the matching isn't totally, so everything does match, yeah. We can verify things entirely on CFT. Okay, right, so before moving on, I should have said this. So I gave some rules constructing that black hole, and so what does that black hole look like? Well, let's write down the metric. Let's look at the non-rotating case just for simplicity. So the metric will take this generic form, but what you find, rather surprisingly, is you have these two functions of the radial coordinate rho, both of which are positive definite. So in fact, this is not a black hole at all. There's no event horizon, right? F has to vanish for there to be an event horizon. What this thing is, it's a traversable wormhole. In fact, the asymptotic behavior of F and G is that of ADS3. So this solution is actually some wormhole that connects two ADS3s together, and you can just happily walk back and forth from one ADS3 to the other.
This happens whenever the spin-free charge is non-zero.
The limit of the spin-free charge goes to zero. No, the limit of the spin-free charge is BTC. So in that special limit, it goes back over the BTC, but for any value of the spin-free charge, that's right. Okay, so this stage, what does that have to do with black holes, you might say? Well, again, no one said that the metric is not gauge invariant. No one said this causal structure was gauge invariant. And so you can ask, can you do a gauge transformation to actually transform this thing into a black hole? And rather amazingly, the answer is yes. If you work hard enough, you can find a very explicit gauge transformation that takes this metric into something which has the exact same causal structure as a non-rotating BTC black hole, but only if you had those precise holonomy conditions that I told you. Only if you fix the charges in precisely the way that I said, can you do this. And so this gave sort of independent evidence for that, that you carry this gauge transformation, and indeed a horizon appears after the gauge transformation. And so the sense in which these things are black holes is that the gauge invariant statement is that we're going to call something a black hole is if somewhere on a gauge orbit there is a metric which is your usual notion of a black hole metric.
How do you associate a temperature with this space-time as opposed to the black hole representative? I mean, it's a natural question. There should be some gauge invariant notion of the temperature, right?
Yeah, so this thing, of course, here, I could just compactify imaginary time with any period I want. So I could give any temperature I want, okay? And so that's why, the only way I know if racing is engaging the right way is through the holonomies. So I work out the holonomies, and that's what tells me what the temperature is.
Yeah. There's only one black hole along the holonomy.
Yes, that's right. There's only one black hole. There's a unique black hole on this orbit, that's right. But okay, now it's very interesting. So in ordinary gravity used to be extremely confusing. Like that two gauge equivalent metrics with different causal structures, you can just probe the thing and see whether you can get from one side to the other. But again, this is where the fact that if you add matter to these theories, this is a non-local theory. And so it's non-local, and so it's not clear that you can actually make it, say, from one side to the other if you took into account the fact that the matter fields are interacting with all these other backgrounds. So we should do a calculation. So last topic here. Now we want to go on to generalizing all this, as I said before, to the intricate of these higher spin theories, the ones that are based on infinite number of higher spin fields. Okay? So again, this is now in the framework of what Gabardino and Kopenkumar conjectured, the large and limit of this cosine model. And in this case, the bulk higher spin theory is, well, the pure higher spin part is again based on Chern Simons theory, but now it's an infinite dimensional Lie algebra, which has a name. That name is HS lambda. Okay, and this was originally proposed by Blenko, and then it's been used by Vasiliev. Okay, so this HS lambda is some Lie algebra, it's an infinite dimensional Lie algebra, and it's based on some infinite regeneration. There's some associative product whose details are long and unilluminating and complicated, so I'm not going to write them out, just to say there is some associative product sitting there, and so I can define a Chern-Simons theory based on this product. In fact, for one special value of lambda, turns out for lambda equals 1/2, this product is a Mayow product from non-commutative geometry, actually. But it generalizes that to other values of lambda. Another point worth noting is if you stick in lambda equals n, actually this Lie algebra goes back over to SLn. But the reason this is relevant in the current context is if you go through the asymptotic symmetry analysis for the Chern-Simons theory based on this algebra, you get back this W infinity of lambda algebra, which is believed to be governing the asymptotic symmetries of this CFT in the large end limit. Okay, so based on these symmetry considerations, there's reason to believe that there could be a duality here. But there's more than that symmetry going on because it's not just the pure higher spin theory that's in here. There are also matter multiplets, which are needed to account for all the primaries on the side. So there's more going on, this is definitely still a conjecture at this point. But
when you were doing computations that you just reviewed, you were not using this theory.
I was using SL3 Chern-Simons theory, and so now that was a theory with just graviton in the spin through field. And now we're going to do analogous computations, but in this infinite dimensional algebra, which has an infinite power of higher spin fields in the bulk.
But the SL3 case is just some candidate dual, or this is just some subject of?
Yeah, there's no candidate dual, partly because there's no known CFTs which have W-free symmetry and large central charge. There are known examples. We have C2 or something, but not that was a large central charge.
Even for a large n, there would be no example because you want this HS of lambda, not the HS of n. So SLn for large n also doesn't have them.
That's right. It doesn't have, and there are, well, yeah, there's no candidate right now. Part of the reason for this is actually if you want to couple in propagating matter fields into this Chern-Simons theory, at least according to current understanding, you need an infinite dimensional gauge algebra. The finite dimensional gauge algebra is actually not known how to add in propagating degrees of freedom, which is stuck with the topological sector. But I'm not sure if that's a fundamental problem or just a lack of understanding.
Your lambda runs from 1 to 0, right?
So HS lambda, the definition of Lie algebra lambda can mean anything. But of course, yes, here in this duality, lambda runs between 0 and 1. Yeah, the right-hand side naively makes sense outside that window, but this duality is restricted to lambda between 0 and 1. Okay. Right, so we consider now the same sort of Chern-Simons theory based on this, and then plus there's some additional matter. And, we do the same thing we did before. We turn on some higher spin chemical potential. The simple thing is to turn on one higher spin chemical potential with a spin 3 guy. But now, this spin 3 chemical potential, because of nonlinear structure of the theory, basically sources an infinite number of charges. And with some black holes, an infinite number of charges, where we fix all their values by demanding this infinite number of these holonomy constraints. And so the whole thing is actually determined. You can solve it just algebraically, basically. And so you find the black hole, and you have to do this perturbatively in the chemical potential. So there's some long analysis here. I'll spare you all details. At the end of the day, you get some answer for the partition function of this black hole. Written out here are some power series in the chemical potential divided by tau squared, tau being this is inverse temperature. Okay, and so we don't have the closed formula here, but we can work this out to more or less any desired order. Eric works hard enough. And you should think of this thing as being valid in this limit. So tau goes to zero is the high temperature limit. Tau is the inverse temperature. And you're taking alpha to zero as well, keeping this thing fixed. OK, so this is our prediction. This thing should agree with the CFT partition function in that limit. OK, so let's try to test this. So again, here's the general state. Here's the general framework. Should be possible to test this for any value of lambda, but it turns out there are simplifications at the two endpoints. So the two endpoints are lambda equals 0 and 1. And what happens there is, in fact, there that orbital algebra W infinity of lambda actually has some free fermion and boson representations of those at these two special points. So lambda equals 0, you can actually represent that algebra by free fermions and W infinity of 1 by free bosons. And so there's some subtle questions about whether this is actually an exact equivalence between these theories or just that the algebra is not really understood, but that's to be determined. But anyway, given this representation of the algebra, we have some ways to do computations here in the CFT. So here's the kind of free boson calculation we do. So we take enough complex bosons to give the right central charge, standard free boson OPE, standard stress tensor. And then you look for a spin 3 current in this theory. We're going to add on a spin 3 tau potential. So I want to work out a spin 3 current, work out its charge, put that in the partition function, compute. Okay. So this object here is sort of manifestly a dimension 3 operator, and it's primary, as it turns out. And so it's a spin 3 current. And then you fix its coefficient here by normalizing against what you have on the gravity side. That's a two-point function to do the same thing. That's that coefficient. Okay, then the rest of the calculation, partition function, is just some like undergraduate SAT-MET type calculation. You just, you know, the key thing is here, everything is quadratic in the bosons here. This current is quadratic. So when you compute the partition function, it's just three fields. So it's elementary. Okay, so you just expand everything in modes, work out a trace, it's just minor extension of the usual kind of partition function for free bosons. And it will work, and you get this explicit answer. Okay, here, and so now we get a closed form answer in terms of the integral now for, in terms of the same parameter alpha, or tau squared. And so you can take this and just expand out in parts of alpha and do the integrals. And we're very happy to find that, in fact, the expansion of this thing precisely matches the expansion of this thing for lambda equals 1. Okay, so we can get precise agreement between this free boson partition function and this black hole guy, even though this stage of the calculations, I have to say, look pretty darn different. So there should be some way we can prove this all orders, but don't understand it yet, but it seems to be working. Okay, there's some analogous in the free fermion sides. It's all very analogous. The one extra complication here is that we have a free fermions, there's a natural spin 1 current. But there's no spin 1 field in the bulk, so you have to basically project that out. So you have to work a partition function with the constraint that the spin 1 charge is 0, and you put that in and do the same kind of calculations and expand it out again. Okay. It matches up the order that we checked for lambda equals 0. Okay. So that gives us good confidence in these rules, which are a little bit based on guesswork initially, but for defining the black holes and thermodynamics is actually making sense. It matches up nicely with these.
Can you form these
black holes?
Yeah.
That's of course an excellent question. So we don't know the answer to that. So what we have to do is in the bulk, I mean, there's you have to look at there's scalar fields in the bulk, and you want to collapse them, see if you can form them. Yeah, I don't know, from the fact that it's a free CFT, does that tell you whether you can or can't form them? So it's unclear. So you might say that, well, if it's a free theory, then how do you thermalize? Yeah, that's, of course. Right, we don't know.
So can you go back to the bosons? So these for SL3 or for the general case?
This is for the general case. I'm only doing a calculation here where I just turn on chemical potential just for the spin 3. I could generalize this to any.
Please recover the number of those.
Exactly. So you can know where the spin 4 current, all the currents have some expressions here in terms of the free bosons.
Mm-hmm.
So
So
what is the content in the work of this unit for this particular layer of boundary?
Well, it's this particular higher spin theory with this algebra HS1, which, yeah, from the Bolt point of view, it doesn't, you wouldn't suspect this thing is becoming free bosons. It doesn't look, it's an interacting theory and so on and non-local, so that's why it's rather amazing to the calculation to get agreement between the series when one looks non-trivially interacting with this free. So, but you know, it must be some change of variables or something.
You need an infinite number of bosons in the parameter, right? Because this goes up to the level, which is k equals infinity.
Well, no, I mean, even the finite number of bosons, you can write down higher and higher spin currents.
I understand that you say you have k equals infinity in this theory, right?
So, yeah. That's right. Ultimately, I want to take k equals infinity. Or, yeah, look at the leading large k behavior. Yeah. Yeah, so if you want to,
with the large number of bosons, is there a large global symmetry that rotates them and that have some appearance in the ball?
Yeah, so then there must be some projections going on here like that. So here there's sort of way too much symmetry because I have all these copies and I can permute them and so on. That symmetry doesn't appear to be there. So I need to put in some additional symmetry considerations, some projections or things. It's not, when I said it's not clear whether these things are really equivalent, but that's precisely the same kind of mind. Equivalent plus some additional projections or something. Yeah.
The bosons are compacted by them?
At this level, it actually doesn't matter. I can't tell, actually. When I look at this leading high temperature behavior, I can't tell if they're compact or not. So, okay. I don't know. Yeah, nothing I do here can tell the difference, actually. So.
So if I look at your previous formula from the graph design, so that means that you can sum this series when lambda equal to 0 and the lambda equal to 1?
Yeah, exactly.
So okay. Do you know how to sum for other values of lambda?
That's the kind of thing we're thinking about now. I don't know.
So also, do you understand that the singularity at lambda is equal to 2?
Oh yeah. This is just some normalization convention actually. There's no physical significance. I can just scale it out. Yeah.
So there's no obvious pathology when lambda greater than 1.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. This is remaining with lambda squared minus 4.
So in the bulk theory, is there a way to see the existence of margin deformation?
Yes, good question. Right, okay, so this comes into, right, so in the bulk theory there are additional scalar fields, and so in this general Silyev theory, as I said before, the masses of the scalars is fixed by the algebra, and so if you ask what is the dimension of the boundary operator, corresponding to those fields, you get a formula that delta the 1 plus or minus lambda. And so at lambda equal to 1, which is the case of the free bosons, the plus branch here gives delta equals 2, the marginal operator. And so in fact, the scalar field, well, so there's the natural marginal operator here in the CFT, which is the d phi, d bar phi, and that operator should indeed be mapped to the scalar field on bulk. So in fact, we should be able to compute correlation functions and so forth of this marginal operator in terms of that scalar. That was
performing some interaction.
Yeah. So for fermions here, so the corresponding thing here gives so lambda equals 0. So now we get this dimension 1 operator. The marginal. Yeah, so then that's less clear. I don't know actually what that one would be. Because there's the current, might be like current is actually projected out, so yeah, I'm not sure about that one.
Question, like on the boundary CFT, do you know the marginal operators? Or can you think of some that would maybe make it an interacting theory that could
thermalize. Right, so I think that was the question I just asked. So this is all I know here about this the lambda equals one with this marginal operator. So I don't know anything more than it's written down here.
So for formulating theory, you can change the Luttinger parameter.
Change which?
Luttinger parameter.
Luttinger parameter. Mm-hmm.
The
radius. You mean bosonizing and then changing the radius of the. I have enough scalar fields to make up the sentence charge, basically. So.
In the bulk, sorry.
Oh, in the bulk, there's. According to the definition, there's basically two scalar fields. Is the proposal.
And the
Yeah, exactly.
Which is very, very different from string theory.
It's hard to run it. It may or may not be worth it. Yeah.
I mean, is it possible that it's actually secretly the minimum of some scalar potential that is what you're talking about?
Yeah. I guess I would say the equations of the theory can be written down in some background independent way without reference to an ADS. And then you find a solution there, and that solution is ADS.
So you did not have a
hard. Well, I don't know how to. So if you're asking me, what is like, is there some field that oscillates?
Yeah.
That's what you're asking. Yeah. That. Yeah. You'd think so. I don't. Yeah. Given that I can find. Yeah. You think there would be? I don't know. What it means, but. Okay. I'm basically. Done here. Okay, so the main result here was basically we established in 2+1 dimensions the rules for incorporating black holes into this higher spin gravity theory. It gave some predictions of the asymptotic growth of states in the CFT, and then in some cases now we can verify that by comparing to these free boson and fermion CFTs. And so I think there are a lot of future directions here. I think so. Well, these cases are the free. Cases are especially interesting. Can we actually show a full ADS-CFT duality between the free theory and the bulk theory? And all the calculations are definitely doable. It's just a matter of working it out. And then, of course, there are questions about higher dimensions. Of course, in 3+1 bulk, there are various duality proposals there, involving higher spins, involving free ON models. Again, there's predictions there for what the thermodynamics should be from the CFT, but how to describe black holes in those bulk theories is not an issue at all, but that's an obvious challenge. And so, anyway, yeah, so I think there are definitely more interesting things to be done. I'll stop there.
So just to follow up on this question for a minute, I mean, when you start with this Chern-Simons form of the bulk action, there's no dimensionful parameter in your action. So when you get ADS as a solution, you really have a one-parameter family of solutions where the ADS length scale is a free parameter.
So in Chern-Simons, you're going to be the level K.
Yeah.
And that's the only parameter, and K ends up being the ADS radius divided by the Planck. That's the only parameter.
So Newton's constant appears in here?
You find it's the central charge. That is the Brown nose central charge, which is my free parameter. And so then I just use the usual C equals 3L over 2G.
There's no lengths.
I think the length scale is introduced by hand when you rewrite the theory of metric variables. In the translation between metric and Chern-Simons variables, we put it in. I thought they'd be called the length scale.
Exactly, yeah, that's right. Yeah, goes all the way back to the. Yeah. So LL appears right here. That's where L appears. There's no L until I
choose to write it that way.
Yeah.
You couple a scalar to gravity, or does it couple to the dimension?
Yeah, so an issue sort of there. So in fact, a scalar basically appears in the bifundamental of this Chern-Simons theory. So it couples to both. So it appears in the higher spin cycle, right? Basically have a and a bar, and they don't talk to each other. And the scalars and have some bifundamentals that couple them together. And what's very interesting is the equation for that bifundamental is a first order equation, but it
at the end of the day, I can use an unpack and solve for auxiliary field that ends up in span around ADS just being the common coordinate equation for a scalar. But then have additional interactions on top of that.
In the case of user jump signs, the issue to jump sign the bulk and the user W3 at the boundary, there's relation between the, at least for the quantum form case, there's a relation between the correlators at the space-time correlators at the boundary and the wave function in the bulk. Is there, but there's no black holes or anything like that, as you mentioned. So, can I find the correlators of your theory, the space-time correlators? Is there some relation to the bulk wave function? Or?
Yeah.
Like ground state wave function.
The whole theory is, that's right, I don't know. And the whole theory is more than just Chern-Simons theory. Yeah. Chern-Simons theory is just the pure. So it's possible to know that can hold true for the correlators of the currents. There's definitely more on top of that. But I want to go back to those arguments and try to run them.
So there is a sense that the ADS-CFT is always a generating function within the boundary theory. It's like a wave function in the bulk, right? So that's generally applies to ADS-CFT.
So
No, just generating function in terms of source, when you write it in terms of the source, that generating function can integrate as a wave
function. It's a wave function, which I'm
saying. Yeah, we can integrate as a wave function for the whole gravitational theory in the bulk, which is this boundary condition.
I'm not sure, is it true? It's the electrons, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this wave function is a minor thing, so many electron wave functions.
Yeah, I'm just saying there's a sense that the generating function is being
I'm not sure it's the same.
It may not be the same.
No, it's not the same. Even in the
In some famous case of ADS-CFT, like ADS-3 cross S3 cross T4, that T4, you know, the conformal field theory is just a sigma model on T4 to the n mod Sn. If you've got a, you know, some very simple torus, it's basically just a theory of a bunch of free bosons of identifications. So do those real string examples have a lot of this physics in them, or is there some big difference? I mean, it's three bosons and fermions, it's a torus, but it's supersymmetric, sigma model on the torus.
You're asking basically there's some stringy version of this whole.
Yeah, to get the order fold points in these ADS3 cross S3 cross X, it's almost a free field theory, sigma model up to these identifications. And, so it doesn't look so different from what you've got here.
Yeah, I mean, naively, in the bulk, you know, it's much more, you know, the whole string theory, so yeah. So it seems like it shouldn't be the same.
The dual field theory seems pretty similar.
Right, it's really free.
I mean, you wouldn't make this prediction this year.
Mod Sn, you're told exactly what prediction.
Yeah, but you're not, I mean, you're having way more degrees of freedom, right?
There.
You have this Q1 times Q5 bosons, yeah. As opposed to taking only the highest spin currents.
So you say maybe this will be like a projection of those theories where you identify all of those.
We also have the twisting state.
Yeah, so that's like a matrix theory. This is like
the Cassandra theory.
Yeah, so
yeah.
It is, in that sense, it's a little
like
a matrix theory.
Yeah, it's a little bit of the C is on like an N1, N5 in those cases.
As opposed to just linear.
So you said that the bulk theory is no longer. So what do you mean that the action for the original scalars is have to do with the W and the R, not the other fields in that?
I mean, the equations of motion are not explicit. They are just, if you work it out, there's a series of higher derivatives, and it doesn't truncate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you say that the preferred number of scalar fields in the bulk is exactly 2?
That's what seems to be needed to agree with the coset.
So, according to Vasiliev and friends, can I add an arbitrary number of scalars in the ball?
Yeah. Yeah, you can add there's like Chan Patton factors and have additional UN symmetries there.
I think the number number of scalars. Well, I guess you said that you can only add scalars for the infinite in algebra.
That's right. Yeah. So the mass is a fixed, but you can introduce arbitrary numbers.
But do you have a feeling for what happens to your, if anything interesting happens to your Cardi formula type calculation if I make the number of bulk scalars very, very large?
Yeah, so in the Cardi formula we have here, the scalars aren't doing anything. In the black hole, the scalars are just turned off.
Right.
So the way the scalars will show up, you might want to keep fluctuation determinants around the black hole. So if you don't add enough of them, then
they correct you, don't want to do correction to your Cardi formula.
You mentioned entanglement entropy. You also calculated that. I can directly check for free from air and goes on the result is completely
entropy.
Entanglement entropy.
Oh, entanglement entropy. Okay, that I haven't thought about it.
Also, free from air and goes on is a trivial result. You can just some log and multiply that as under charge.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it if you did the entangled entropy in the bulk here. Also, we have a world sheet here. Does it make sense to introduce a world sheet into this theory? So, how does it couple these higher spin fields? I don't know the answer to that.
Do you want to lay down or maybe we should have further discussion for the bulkers?